My voice has been especially bad as of late, and it's really bad tonight, so we're going to try our best to get through this. But if a brave volunteer wants to step up and help me out, then I'd appreciate it. All right, we're going to pause just for two lessons tonight and Sunday morning from the Nehemiah story to look at Malachi's prophecy. We did the same with Haggai and Zechariah, as you remember. Took two lessons apiece on both of those prophecies. We only have four classes left, so it's two from Malachi this class and Sunday, and then the last two classes will be lesson 19, which is pages 45 through 47. And that will take us through the end of the quarter. But as you remember, we looked at Haggai and Zechariah's prophecies. They were a little easier to determine when they spoke, because we have at the start of each of those prophecies, there was some information as to when they prophesied. It was in Darius' second year, which was about 520 B.C. And just to do a short review, why was it that God sent Haggai and Zechariah? Anybody remember? You can look back in your folder if you want to. Or not. He sent them for a specific purpose. That's right. Particularly finished what work? That's right. They had stalled on the temple, as you recall, that lay there for how many years? Long time. 16 years. And they had started pursuing their own interests, building their own houses instead of building the Lord's house. And so God sent those two servants to stir the people up, rebuke them, to reprove them, and to get their attention. And again, those prophecies were easier to plug in the two books for this quarter that we're devoting ourselves to, which is Ezra and Nehemiah. We don't have that luxury with Malachi. We don't know exactly when he prophesied. So we're just guessing that it's going to be here. Now, our guess may be wrong, but for our purposes, that'll suffice. So some of the things that we see in Malachi's prophecy does coincide with what we see in Nehemiah. And so that being the case, a popular date or a date that's usually chosen for this prophecy is somewhere around 432 B.C., 440 to 432, 425, somewhere in that range. That's good enough for us. We're going to go with this one. That's sort of right in the middle of that time frame. Just to sort of connect back to what we talked about, it's been at least 90 years since Zechariah and Haggai were sent. So almost a century since God sent those two servants. If this date, of course, be correct. It's been at least 25 years since Ezra came back. And as you remember, the book of Ezra, which is what we started with in this quarter, chapters 1 through 6 of that book covered the first return led by Zerubbabel, which the purpose for that return was, again, build the temple. Chapters 7 through 10 of his book covered the second return led by Ezra, about 458 B.C., to rebuild the spiritual condition of the people, what we're calling the spiritual infrastructure. And if this date be correct for Malachi's prophecy, then it's about 25 or so years after Ezra led his return. As you remember from Nehemiah chapters 9 and 10, our last two classes, the remnant took this vow, and they signed this document, and basically the vow or the pledge and the name signing was for what purpose? What were they vowing or pledging? Yeah, we're going to do better. We've done some bad things in the past. We've left a lot of things undone, but now we're going to stick to it. We're going to do better. If this is the correct place to plug Malachi's prophecy, then again, it seems the remnant slipped back into some apathy again. even if it's not, if we're incorrect with our date on Malachi's prophecy, when we get to lesson 19, which is the last three chapters of Nehemiah, there are some indications in those three chapters that they did slip back and did not remain as faithful as they had promised. So, I don't mean to put them in a bad light if we're incorrect about our date on this. And even if we are, the last of the book of Nehemiah does indicate that they did not remain as faithful as they wanted to. What's unique about Malachi? Well, the style of Malachi's prophecy is different than all the other, what we call the minor prophets. Technically, it's called the dialectic style. And someone says, well, what is that? Well, as you read the prophecy, and it starts right off chapter 1 and verse 2 of Malachi's prophecy, it's got three elements to it. Number one, a charge or an assertion is made, a formal charge. And then the charge is questioned. It's objected to, or the objection is anticipated by the one who's making the charge. And then, of course, the third element would be, well, evidence is provided. And look in Malachi 1 and verse 2. You'll see it right off. Here's the 10 verses right there where you'll see this is done all throughout Malachi's prophecy. This sort of gets us to our first question. The statement is, I have loved you. That's an affirmation, a positive affirmation. What was the question? Next part of the verse. But you say, how have you loved us? Where's the proof of that? Then you get the answer following that. So that's the format of Malachi's prophecy. It's mostly found in chapter 1. And then there's a couple of references. And by the way, your material, there's a typo there on that last line above question 1. I've got chapter 2, 14:14. Did you catch that? That's incorrect. That should be chapter 2, 14, verse 17. So 14:17, not 14 listed twice there. So I apologize for that. But here's all the references where you have this example of this didactic, dialectic style of the public speaking. The charge is made. Usually it's in a negative sense. You've not done this, or you've done this wrong. The question is, how have we done this wrong? And then the proof is given. It's just that the first one is more of a positive affirmation. God's saying, I've loved you. The question is, how have you loved us? I haven't seen any evidence of your love. And then God gives the proof of His love of the people. Okay, so let's get into the questions. And let's look at the first five verses together of Malachi chapter 1. This is God's message to the remnant. He affirms His love for Israel. I have loved you. The question is, how have you loved us? This is disputed by the remnant. And what's God's proof that He's loved them? He says, you I have loved, and Esau I've hated. Now, why would He bring up Esau? Well, but before we answer that, why do you think the remnant would dispute God's love? If He says, I loved you, and they say, how hast thou loved us? Where's the proof of thy love? Why would they even question that? We're not told in the book. Do a little speculating. Well, all right, captivity certainly was maybe still on their minds. Of course, they've been back now for, well, over 100 years. Okay, I think that's mainly it. Some things have been promised, haven't they? Especially through the prophets. Hold your place there. Turn just one book back to Zechariah. Let's look at three quick examples. We will not spend a lot of time on this. But in chapter 6 of Zechariah, verses 11 through 15. Now again, it's been 90 years, if our date from Malachi is correct. It's been about 90 years since Zechariah prophesied. But in his prophecy, he promised, he predicted, there would be a special one that would come, the Messiah. And in that section of his prophecy, he would occupy what two offices? Look at verse 13. Priest and king. Priest, and he'd be both priest and king. Has it happened yet when Malachi comes? Hasn't happened yet. Well, maybe they were expecting something more physical, more earthly than what Zechariah prophesied. Even if they agreed that it was going to be spiritual, when Malachi comes, had the Messiah come yet? No, not yet. So perhaps they were looking for that. In chapter 8 of Zechariah's prophecy, the first 13 verses, if you read those verses again real quickly, you'll see what he had talked about was that, let's see. Look at verse 5. The streets of the city will be filled with boys and girls playing in its streets. Be a lot of people. What was the condition of the remnant as we saw in the latter verses of Nehemiah? Remember how the city was described? It was spacious, but few people in it. So this hadn't come to pass yet. You keep on reading down through here. Look at verse 12. There will be peace for the seed. The vine will yield its fruit. The land will yield its produce. Heavens will give their due. I'll cause the remnant of this people to inherit all these things. You may be a blessing. Verse 13. What was pretty much their economic condition during this time? Still not prosperous. So maybe they thought that. Maybe that's why they were questioning God's love for them. And then in chapter 8, verses 20 through 23, the prophet also said that Zion would be filled with peoples from all the nations, all the Gentiles would come up to Jerusalem and start worshiping. Now again, that was a messianic prophecy. But had it happened as of the days of Malachi? Still not yet. Not yet. So here's just three quick indicators. And I can't say for sure this is why they questioned God's love. But these are indicators from Zechariah's previous prophecy. And this could be why they said, "How hast thou loved?" We don't see any evidence. The things that's been promised to us, they've not been fulfilled. They've not come about. That's one possibility that at least is I'm not sure how likely it is, but it's very possible. And so this could have caused them to doubt God's love. Well, here's the answer. I've loved Israel, but I've hated Esau. Now, we spoke about some of this on Sunday night when we reviewed the book of Obadiah in our sermon. What's some of the basic, we won't go through all of it for sake of time, but what were some of the basic parts of the story between Jacob and Esau from the Old Testament that you know about the history between these two? All right, Jacob stole the birthright and the blessing. He stole both of them. Yes, when they were still in the womb of their mother, the Lord said, "The older shall serve the younger." And that's what happened, obviously. When Obadiah came upon the scene, what had Edom done? Which, of course, Edom comes from Esau. What had they done? They did. They gloated over Israel's misfortune, their calamities in the day that God sent that coalition of Arabs and Philistines to plunder them because of Jehoram's wickedness in Judah. So he says, "I've rejected Esau." Why did God reject Esau? Because what had Esau done? He rejected God, hadn't he? Turn to Hebrews. Go ahead, Freddie. Yes. Turn to Hebrews 12. Let's look at that passage real quickly. Hebrews chapter 12. Rob, read for us verses 14 to 17, please, of Hebrews 12.
"Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For you know that after
Again, how does verse 16 describe Esau? Profane, immoral, fornicator, godless, whatever your version says. So technically speaking, or just generally speaking, what kind of man was Esau? He wasn't spiritual. He didn't care. Did he care about his birthright? No, he thought more of a bowl of stew than he did about this great blessing of being the firstborn of his father. So he was a common man, a profane man. He didn't care about God. He didn't care about the ways of God. And his descendants, even many generations after him, the people of Edom, did they care about God's people Israel? No. And the prophecy of Obadiah proves that, which we talked about again Sunday night. And so Obadiah is sent by God, and he pronounces that judgment upon them. Now back here in Malachi 1, and the last part of verse 3, I think you see a reference to the prophecy of Obadiah. Because as you recall, Obadiah in his preaching said to Edom, who said in her pride, "We've made our home in the mountain strongholds, who'll bring us down?" And what did God say? "I'll bring you down. I'll take care of you," which he did. And so Malachi 1 and verse 3, God says through the prophet, "I have made his mountains a desolation and appointed his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness." So that's how he says, "I've hated Esau, but I've loved you." Now Obadiah was sent some 400 years before Malachi was sent. And yet, I believe again, verse 3 of Malachi 1, he references Obadiah's prophecy. Now, had Israel done bad? Well, they had, of course. And what did God do with them? He sent them off into captivity. But what has been the whole theme of our quarter? What did he do with his people after captivity? He brought them back home. What did he do to Edom? He destroyed him. What's that a sign of? Hate Esau or Edom, and I love my people. God gave his people a second chance. So again, the abundant, or the evidence is abundant. "I have loved you," God says. They said, "How hast thou loved us?" Well, the proof is all right there. And God again tells them, "Well, Esau I took care of, but you, I've brought you back from captivity." Yes, Vic. Yes. 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 Yes, I think that's a good way to put that. Man can be so impatient, can he? If God's promised something, how soon do we want it? Well, like, how about right now? But when it doesn't come that fast, then we get a little impatient. And we start to complain, we start to murmur about some things, and a fall off in our faith and our diligence. So God references Edom's punishment in verse 3, and by bringing back the remnant from captivity, God did show that he loved them. So there's the first little exchange through verse 3. Edom had no future, verse 4 indicates. The remnant was now starting their future, that is, coming back under the leadership of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and now Nehemiah. They were starting their new life in their home again. And verse 5, "Your eyes will see," again there in verse 4, Edom says, "We're going to return and build up the ruins." God says, "They'll say they'll rebuild it, but I'm going to tear it down. They're not going to be victorious over me. I'm going to deal with them in the appropriate way," which he did. And verse 5, the prophet says to Israel about Esau or Edom, "Your eyes will see this. You'll see Edom's destruction, and you will say, 'The Lord be magnified beyond the border of Israel.'" Seeing what would happen to Edom, and God saying beforehand what's going to happen, and they see it, that should cause faith in Israel. When God says something, that's what he does. That's what happens. And so, that being the case, when God says, "I love you," then what should you believe? You should believe that he loves you, that he cares for you, and he's concerned about you. So there's the initial message through the prophet Malachi. Now, the rest of chapter 1, we see yet another example. In fact, it's more than one time in this section where you see this didactic, dialectic style again, where the charge is made, it's objected to, and the evidence is clearly shown. Verses 6 through 14. This gets us to question 3 on top of page 42. To what did God liken himself? To what did he compare himself to in the first part of verse 6? A father and a master, both. He says, a father receives what from his son? Honor. What's a master get from his slave? Fear or respect. And he says, now, keep in mind, this is at verse, is it in verse 6 that it says this? He's speaking to the priests. Yes. So this is primarily against the priests. Although I think it would apply to all the remnant. But remember, the priests are in positions of leadership. They're the ones who officiate at the altar. They're the ones who officiate at worship. And if the worship has been defiled and if the worship is irreverent, then who's primarily to blame? It would be the priests. They should lead in that matter, and they did not. So this is directed mainly at the priests. All right. God sees himself as a father and a master. And he says, a father deserves honor. And a master deserves fear or respect from his slave. What was God getting? Neither. He was getting none of that. First part of verse 6. So here's the style again. After his opening statement, a son honors his father and a servant his master. Then if I am a father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my respect? Says the Lord of hosts to you, O priests, who despise my name. Now there's the charge. What was the question? Last part of verse 6. You see it? Well, how have we despised thy name? They objecting to that. They don't appreciate that charge. Well, where was the proof? Look at verse 7. Yes, you are presenting defiled food upon my altar. But you say, here's the question again. See, the charge is, you're defiling the altar. What was the question? Well, how are we defiling the altar? In that you say, the table of the Lord is to be despised. But when you present, what were the sacrifices based on verse 8? What kind were they? Blind, maimed, crippled. They had some defect one way or another. And what was the problem with that? That's right. We talked about this some Sunday morning. We used Malachi 1 in our sermon Sunday morning. What did the law say about sacrifices at that place right there? You bring me the first ones, and it's got to be no defects. It's got to be the best. And here they are bringing the crippled and the maimed and the not so good, the not so best. And as far as God was concerned, he didn't appreciate that. And it wasn't the right thing to do, obviously. So here's an important principle for us to consider. Whether you're a Jew living in the days of the remnant or whether you're a Christian living in the days of the New Testament now, what if you show contempt for the worship of God? Then really, what you're showing contempt for is who? God himself. If God has specified how he wants to be worshipped, and he's told us, let's use this example right here. He had said in that passage right there regarding sacrifices, here's what I demand upon the altar. And he laid it out, specified it. And then you don't bring it. You bring, in fact, not just do you not only bring, not bring what he says to bring, but you bring what you're not supposed to. You give him what he says he didn't want. Then what are you doing to God? Let's call it what it is. You're disregarding who he is. You're thumbing your nose at what he has said. And you're in essence, you might as well just say the words, I don't care what you said. I'm going to bring what I want anyway. That's what they were doing. Now, can that still be found among his people today? It most certainly can. How can we show a similar guilt in our worship? We're not bringing animals anymore to sacrifice. So how can our worship today be as contemptible as that? All right, you're not worshiping from the heart. All right, like what? Let's roll the piano in down here. All right, let's have a choir. Let's have whatever else we can think of, some carnal activity, and we're going to call it worship. And we've got to come up with all these examples. I can come in these doors every time the building's open and sit in my pew and sing and pray, or act like I'm singing and praying, and my heart's not here. I'm here bodily, but my heart's not here. Well, if I'm sitting beside you, would you know that? Well, I guess you could if my facial expression showed it. But what if I really put on the act and play a good game? You're not going to know it, but see, that's not the point. The point is what? God's going to know it. God's going to know it. And so that's the concern we have to think about. When we come to worship, we must worship Him as He has told us in the New Covenant and make sure that we do it just exactly like He says He wants it, because He's our Father and He's our Master. Isn't it the same? He's our Father, we owe Him honor. He's our Master, we owe Him respect and fear. Yes, Vic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, right. Yes, right. Yes. All things could, I mean, we could come up with all sorts of activities and things that at least sound good to men and seem pleasing to us, but if the Lord hasn't authorized it and we do it anyway, then we're showing just as much contempt for Him today as they did back here by bringing in their maimed animals for sacrifices. And that's an important principle for us to realize. So, that being said, Malachi sort of gives a sarcastic exhortation. This is question four. What does he say to them? There in verses, last part of verse 8 through verse 9. Yeah. Well, if this is such a good thing to do, then won't you give it to your governor? By the way, who was the governor? If our time is correct on the prophecy, who is it? It's Nehemiah. Try giving it to Nehemiah. And he asked the question, would he be pleased with it? No, he wouldn't like it. Well, if they knew he wouldn't like it, then why would they think God would like it? Especially since God has said in His Word, back in the law, to not give Him those kinds of animals. They didn't care. That's why we call it apathy. They didn't care. They're going to give anything they want and just expect God to be pleased with it. And that's how man does God. As long as I'm happy with it, then surely God's going to be happy with it. And it doesn't work that way, does it, brethren? It doesn't work that way at all. God's got to be happy with it, whether I like it or not. I better learn to like it if God wants it. That's how that should work. So He deserves a lot more respect and honor than earthly fathers and earthly masters because of who He is. So we're talking about this idea of New Testament worship. So God's true fitness, and again, this is the verse we referenced Sunday morning, Malachi 1 and verse 10. Here they're bringing in all this stuff on the altar. And what did God say? Well, I have no pleasure, but he sort of expressed His desire about what He wished would happen. I wish somebody, just one of them, would get up and do what? Close the gates. Shut the doors. And that way you would stop uselessly. My burden says, there in verse 10, you would stop, where is it? That you might not uselessly kindle fire on my altar. So what God is saying was, it would be better not to worship than to worship and do the wrong thing. Because with God, one isn't any better or worse than the other. Now, did the law say to worship? Yes, the command was to worship. But God is saying, if that's the best you can do, and that's how you're going to do it, but I just want you to shut the doors. And don't even bother. Yes, that's right. To obey is better than sacrifice. So now, let's make the application. What if the best we can do, and I sort of said this Sunday morning, what if the best that we can do is come in here and just half-hearted sing, maybe drop a dollar or two in the plate, not really care about the preaching, whether it's, you know, just I wish he'd hurry up and sit down and shut up. I'm getting tired of hearing him. And I don't really care about the supper. Oh, I'll eat the bread and drink the juice, but, you know, I'm here to do it, but my heart's not in it. Then what would God likely say? The same thing. Just go ahead and shut the church building doors. That's the best you can do. I'm not impressed with that kind of worship. See, we can easily make the application. Same principles that was found here can be found among us. And we cannot give God that kind of worship. Well, we can, but not successfully. It's just not going to work. Was your hand up, Roger? You scratching your head? Okay. All right. So, this was a prophecy directed mainly at the priests. Now, God tells us His desire for true worship. This is down about question 6. Still in chapter 1. After He says there in verse 10, I am not pleased with you, nor will I accept an offering from you. All right. What did God say He wanted based on verses 11? Let's see, it was 11 and the last part of verse 14. For from the rising of the sun even to its setting, what did God want about His name? I want to be honored. I want my name to be great among the nations. Well, if all the nations are going to see and view God as great, who's that going to start with? His own people. And if they don't view Him as great, then what's the chances of the other nations doing? It's not going to happen. Because they're not even in covenant with Him. If His own people don't do it. Brethren, what if we don't worship God in the appropriate way? Then who else is going to do it? Nobody else is going to do it if we don't do it. It's just that simple. So He wants His name to be great. And look at the last part of verse 14. Again, He says, I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name is feared or to be feared among the nations. Well, that was God's expectation regarding worship. But now the verses that we skipped between verse 11 to verse 14, the last part of it. Now let's look at the verses we skipped. Verses 12 through the first part of verse 14. Kevin, if you'll read those verses for us, please. Verses 12 through the first part of verse 14. Okay. So, even though this is what God expected, this is what He desired, here these verses tell us what He was getting. What was He getting? Well, verse 12. He says, you are profaning it. Does the New King James say profaning? Or the King James? Same thing? Okay. You're making it common. We're profaning means to make something holy, make something sanctified to make it common and ordinary, and that's not what it is. You are profaning my table, my worship, my name. The table of the Lord is defiled, and as for its fruit, its food is to be despised. So they were making it all common. Look also in verse 13. What was the statement that was being heard among the priest and or the remnant about worship? Too much. This is tiring. Do we have to go up there and do that again? How often do they have to make the sacrifices, by the way? Wasn't it on a regular schedule? I mean, there were weekly sacrifices. But what if you sinned? What if you sinned every day? Well, march up there every day with your sacrifice. So it wasn't just weekly. There were sacrifices for all occasions, depending on whatever the situation was. And here they're saying, my version says in verse 13, you also say, my, how tiresome it is. How wearisome this is. You know, there are some Christians who think coming to worship is just weird. It's boring. It's dull. What do you get out of worship anyway, by the way? What do you get from it? Only what you put into it. Right? What if you come in here and don't put anything into worship? Then what are you going to get? You're not going to get anything. But if you come in here and you sing with your heart like you're supposed to, and when the brother leads us in prayer, whoever that is, you fervently pray with him. And when we eat the supper together, you think about Christ and you think about His death, and you try to discern the Lord's body properly. And then whoever the preacher is, whatever the sermon topic is, you know, the Lord's Word's being opened. And we're going to study what He said. If you really participate, then if you really put something into worship, then what are you going to get? You're going to get a lot. You're going to get fed. You're going to have fellowship. You're going to draw closer to God. You're going to draw closer to each other. And so they say that this is just wearisome. It's tiring. It's boring. And that was their attitude, and that was the wrong attitude to take. And again, I think we can see a very easy parallel can be made to New Testament worship today if God's people make the same mistakes and commit the same sins. So this sort of gets us to question 7. Just some present-day applications. Same sin be found among us. And if our sacrifice is not our best, if our attitude toward worship is similar, then why would God be pleased with us? He's not going to be pleased with us. And I'm afraid, I'm not trying to be judge, jury, and executioner, but I think in some cases we've got whole churches affected with apathy. And there's just nothing going on. And that's a shame. Yeah. Yes, we've heard that question before. Somebody comes up and says to a preacher or an elder or a group of elders, well, how much do I have to come? See, on the surface already, what's wrong with that question? What does it indicate? No desire to do it. How much do I have to do? What is the bare minimum I have to do in order to get by and maybe keep the preacher or the elders off my back and to be considered somewhat faithful and good standing? Isn't that just what we're talking about? This is the very thing we're talking about. And that got the remnant in trouble with God. And so, again, if we do this, then we're no better than the remnant to which or to whom God sent Malachi with this rebuke. Yes, that's the typical gauge. Well, so-and-so, brother, he's faithful. Usually we mean what? Oh, he's there at every assembly. And, of course, we're not saying attendance is not important. Of course it is. But that isn't the only gauge. And I wouldn't say it's the primary gauge of faithfulness anyway. What is the primary gauge of faithfulness? Like I said this Sunday, we don't show our devotion just by what we do here in this room. How do you gauge faithfulness? What we do out here every day of the week. How we live. How we treat our neighbors. How we interact with other people. The kind of spouse we are. The kind of children we are. The kind of son or daughter we are. The kind of worker we are on the job. All those things. How we treat our enemies. All those come into play. That's how we show devotion and faithfulness. Well, I think Norma's point is correct. We sort of limit it just to one little shallow surface gauge, and it's, of course, a whole lot more than that. So we know God would not be pleased with such worship. It's just not going to fly with Him. And so we get down through the end of chapter 1. That's pretty much our time for tonight. I think we're at a good stopping spot. So the Lord willing, we'll pick up with question 8 Sunday morning.